LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Paul Burley, who joins us to discuss his book, Stonehenge, As Above, So Below, which identifies the original design and purpose of the Stonehenge ritual landscape. Stonehenge remains one of the most profound mysteries on Earth. We know almost nothing about the people who built it, how they did so, or why. As with the pyramids of Egypt, it seems impossible that Stonehenge could have been constructed using the primitive tools and methods prevalent at the time. Theories about its purpose have ranged from an astronomical observatory to a sacred ceremonial, burial, or even sacrificial site. What seems clear, however, is that ancient civilizations the world over possessed an innate understanding of the relationship between the cycles of life, death, and rebirth, and those of the wider cosmos. The belief that life is everywhere and in all things, and that all things are interconnected, was fundamental to their worldview. It's vital to keep this in mind when contemplating the enigma that is Stonehenge. Stonehenge, As Above, So Below, will change your understanding of the people who built the first and largest monument and many other mid-Neolithic structures that remained vital to the functioning of the sacred landscape. You'll discover that the Stonehenge landscape is the oldest and best preserved example of astronomically related sacred symbolism ever constructed. It's a major breakthrough, unveiling a new paradigm for how Stonehenge was used over 5,000 years ago and how we should view it today. Hello and welcome, Paul, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It's great to be here. Look forward to the discussion.
Paul, today we're going to discuss your brand new book, which is called Stonehenge, As Above, So Below. Subtitle is Unveiling the Spirit Path on Salisbury Plain. Before we dive into that, perhaps you could tell listeners a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in this topic in the first place.
I have a degree in civil engineering and geology, and I've studied the cultural impacts on properties from an engineering and environmental geology perspective for over 25 years. And in 2003, I was in the mountains of Wyoming at the elevation of about 10,500 feet. After dinner, before ascending to the highest peak in this range, I happened to walk upon what I recognized immediately as a Native American medicine wheel, which is composed of boulders and cobbles. It's forming a circle, and then there were a certain number of lines going through the circle, diameters, and in the middle of the circle was a cairn of stones. And I was wondering, I knew what I was looking at, but I was wondering what the symbolism of the circle was. And so I studied that particular symbol, that construction, and a number of others, and finally realized who had built that structure, when, why, and in particular what the symbolism meant. And it had been constructed by the Lakota Indians, and it was prehistoric, pre-Columbian. So I, after discovering that and having a lot of interest in that, I started looking at sacred symbolism in cultures ranging from the ancient to the indigenous around the world and throughout time. And I wrote a book about that, came out 3 years ago, and it's called The Sacred Sphere, because I found that all circular symbols that have anything to do with sacred relationships between you and me, us and the earth, us and the cosmos, and us and the creator, however the culture perceived the creator, is represented by a spherical geometry. And that the easiest way to present that sphere to other people symbolically is a circle instead of trying to draw a sphere. So that's what the first book was about. Then I decided that as a perfect example of this would be Stonehenge, because of all the circles of the henge itself, the ditch and the bank, and then the circles of stones and so forth. So that is why I decided to pursue looking at Stonehenge as an excellent example of how these circular forms represent a sphere, and then ultimately what that sphere is representing by the people who constructed it. So it was a bit of a long process over the last 10 or 11 years, but that's how I really got into it.
Okay, well, obviously Stonehenge is relentlessly fascinating, and it's captured people's imaginations since forever, really. But early on in the book, you make the point that there's been several hundred years of, quite intensive study of the site and other, related things in the area. And that brought me up slightly short, because I thought, what was happening before that? And then I got to thinking, well, was there a time, two questions here. A, did Stonehenge fall out of use at any particular time that we can put a concrete date on, or not specific, just even a period of time? For example, in the Dark Ages, was Stonehenge perhaps used for some ceremonial purpose? Have we got any way of knowing that? So did it ever actually fall out of use? And was there a time when people were, in general, not interested in this pile of rocks in the countryside?
Well, there's no archaeological evidence either way for when Stonehenge was used or not used since the time it was that the monoliths, these large megalithic stones at Stonehenge, were placed in about 2500 BC. So presumably the area was being used and Stonehenge was being used for rituals or ceremonies, something going on. And there were barrows that were being placed over time until about 1000 BC or later around the Stonehenge area. And those barrows can be dated if there are artifacts, archaeological artifacts that are found within them. But as in terms of actual use of Stonehenge in certain areas other than these barrows, there's very little way to determine if and when any part of the landscape, including Stonehenge, was used outside of dating particular structures, these barrows and so forth. So when we move into between 0 AD and 1000 AD, there's very little information there. There weren't burials going on then that we know of. There weren't a lot of structures being built at that time. There's evidence of some human activity, but in terms of ritual activity, sacred activities, there's very little evidence of it. Certainly there were people living in the area. They were aware of Stonehenge. There's no reason to believe that they wouldn't be if they were living in the area. How they were using it, no one knows. Were they using it? No one knows. But presumably there was some interest in it. And over time, some stones got knocked down for whatever reason, broken up, and used in structures otherwise in the area. And that's why we don't have all the stones there. They were used for other engineering projects. So people knew about it. Doesn't seem like they were using it for any specific purpose that we know of, but that doesn't mean that wasn't happening. And then about in the 1600s, we start having this scientific study of the structure. Why is it there? Who built it? When did they do that? And we start getting some archaeological activity, at least pre-scientific. And then up when we start moving into the 1800s, we get some real documentation going on, some good data to use to date the structure and who built it and so forth. But the time frame between 2500 BC and about to the point of about 300 years ago, there's very little information as to exactly when it was used and what it was used for.
In conversations that I have just with other lay people about these sorts of subjects, had one recently about a general one about ancient Egypt and that culture and civilization. And a lot of people sort of say, think that a lot of the answers are in, and that, yes, there are things we'll never be able to discover, but in general, we know a lot about it. Well, with regards to whether it's ancient Egypt or whether it's the Neolithic and Megalithic civilizations, I think that we know, in actual fact, very little. And there may be, barriers as to how much we can ever know. But when it comes to the concept of something like Stonehenge, and of course, as you mentioned a moment ago, there's lots of other structures around there. I mean, the design of it, how it was built, I mean, that in itself, we could talk for hours about, the difficulties that we would experience if we tried to do that today, what it was specifically used for, what place it had in the contemporary culture. I mean, there really are many more questions than answers.
There always will be questions that we're not able to answer because of a lot of the evidence that we would need to answer questions just isn't there. It may never have been left behind by the people who built it and used Stonehenge. So there's always going to be those open-ended questions that we can't answer. However, I believe that there is evidence that has been gathered. There is data out there, especially as a result of archaeological activities, that can be used to answer questions that have been out there for quite a long time and people are perplexed in answering them, this enigma about Stonehenge. And what I've been able to accomplish over the last 3 years or so regarding Stonehenge and the purpose of its use and so forth is a result to a great degree of the data that's already out there that was provided by the archaeological community. But the archaeologists are not using it in a way that can help answer some questions that even they have been trying to answer because they're not skilled, they're not educated, they're not looking at this data from the perspective of the sacred, from a religious standpoint. To a great degree, they're looking at it very pragmatically, that you have to have specific information archaeologically to utilize in order to understand the structure. But if they don't understand the sacred symbolism that's going on that really explains the architecture of Stonehenge in the first place, they'll never be able to understand why that structure is there, because it's pure and simply an architecture architecture in general is symbolism. And so in this case, we have a sacred structure that is very evident to me because it's built in circular form. Almost every facet of Stonehenge is related to the circle in some fashion. And as I was saying before, as a sacred symbol, the circle is representing a sphere. And so the question is, what is that sphere there? And I would propose that this is nothing different from virtually all other ancient and indigenous cultures, especially those living in a Neolithic cultural lifestyle and technology, that circle at Stonehenge is on the ground surface is representing essentially the equator of a sphere. And above that equator is the cosmic dome. And below that equator is Mother Earth. And so this is representing the world, the universe within which human beings and all life on Earth are living within and interacting with each other. And that is the structure that these circles, the ditch and bank in particular, are representing, that within that circle is sacred space. And it is not to be desecrated. It is not an area for people to be entering into unless they are specifically trained and capable of essentially being priests or shaman, that type of thing. But the average person typically in these ancient cultures would not just walk into Stonehenge and participate in some activity because they knew that this was not to be desecrated. It was space that was extremely important to them as sacred space, and they used it for that purpose. So I would propose that is what Stonehenge is all about. It's representing the universe and the importance of life within that universe and continuing life from year in and year out. And that becomes more and more evident as one looks at more of the spatial characteristics of Stonehenge within the environment around which it's located, within that context of what archaeologists consider to be a burial ground. It's much more than a burial ground, but they're right that that's an important component, but they're missing these other spiritual, reincarnation, recreation of life types of things. It's not just death. Landscape is really all about life, and that is what Stonehenge is all about.
Well, it's a little bit like, certainly when I was at school, what I learned, quote unquote, about the Great Pyramid, for example, in Egypt, was that it was a tomb, full stop, end of story, move along, you know?
and there's no evidence of anyone ever being entombed in the Great Pyramid. There is a granite coffin that is in the king's chamber, but that doesn't mean that anyone was ever located within that coffin. And as a matter of fact, I have a chapter in my book, The Sacred Sphere, that is directly discussing the symbolism of that pyramid and what that structure really means. And essentially, that Great Pyramid is representing the same thing as Stonehenge or any other structure that represents a sphere is intended to mean from a sacred standpoint. And ultimately, just to make it quick, in terms of the chapter in the Sacred Sphere, the Great Pyramid is representing the typical human being, which is generally characterized as being Osiris, who is the psychopomp who receives the next king, the next pharaoh back to the stars. Well, that represents any human being within Egyptian society as being welcomed back to where they came from, where their spirit came from, and that's at Orion. In the sky, the constellation Orion, who represents the god Osiris, and this is the area of the cosmos where the spirit comes from and returns, and that is a very important part of the story for the ancient Egyptians, even pre-dynastic Egypt.
Yes, well, people may be aware that around the area of Stonehenge, that greater area of England, I mean, there's a lot of sacred sites dotted around all over the place, some of them more famous than others. But what a lot of people are probably not aware of, and I wasn't certainly aware of the extent of this, is to how much the immediate area around Stonehenge itself is got a whole network of structures and various features on the landscape there.
Yeah, that's right. There are about 400 plus or minus barrows in the area, including round barrows of various specific forms, long barrows, and then there are the henges, there's the greater cursus, the lesser cursus, and then virtually anywhere one would look in the subsurface, if one could peel off the topsoil, one would see evidence of structures, rectangular, square structures, so forth, almost anywhere out there. Now, the evidence for those you can't see on the surface with the vegetation. You've got to remove that topsoil, and archaeologists start to recognize that these structures were built. Now, and that would go, between now and back 6,000 years is when these different structures would be dated, and which ones would be a certain age, no one's determined yet. But the whole area seems to have been covered at one time or another by the occupancy of human beings leaving evidence of these structures behind. And when we look at the sacred structures, these henges and these various barrows and the cursus, it totals about 400 structures within a 2-mile radius of Stonehenge. So there are many, many more than most people recognize as they're touring through the area.
There's a popular idea, I think, which is what a lot of people think, that Stonehenge has been established, that it was basically some sort of observatory for, marking, tracking events in the sky, solstices, whatever it happens to be. But the idea that they would go to the effort that they did to construct something as prosaic as an observatory, even if the events in the skies had great significance for them, it seems for it to be just that would be a little bit simplistic, because let's not forget that the stones that went in to build Stonehenge itself, some of them came from as far as Wales. And when you get into looking about how that might have been done, for example, how they could have been cut and transported, you're into the same sort of conundrums you're into with the Great Pyramid. Basically, this is something that we couldn't do today if we try to replicate it using the methods that a lot of people ascribe to these peoples.
There's no evidence at all that Stonehenge was an observatory. That is a conclusion or an opinion that is reasonable enough for what we know or don't know about Stonehenge, but there's really no evidence to support that opinion. The question is, well, what else could it be then? And that's a very legitimate question, because we need evidence of some purpose for Stonehenge if we're going to draw that conclusion. So the question is, well, what would it be for? Why would all of these stones, the blue stones and the sarsens from 30 miles away to the north of Stonehenge, or coming 240 miles away from Wales, why bring these across overland? or along the shore of the island, around and up to Salisbury Plain, and install these. There had to be in my mind, one, a large labor force to do this work, and two, very good reason for all of these people coming together to do that work. And people will see in the book, there's very good reason to believe that the force that was needed, the number of individuals participating in this, didn't necessarily need to come from across the island, that the population in South Central England back 4,000, 5,000 years ago was likely more than sufficient to support all of this work being done and provide the resources for the manpower to do this work. And it's possible that people came from across Britain, but it isn't necessary that they happen because it looks like there was a significant population in the area. And so we have the manpower potentially relatively locally. As to the, you know, why would they go about this? Because I'm not going to put my time into dragging 40-ton stones around. And no one today is going to attempt to do that. Certainly no one is doing that. No one has for thousands of years. So what was going on there? I believe that the transportation of those stones, as far as it was, had to be related to the will of the people, that these individuals each wanted to contribute to what was being constructed, because this was a vital project. It was important for every individual and important for the culture. And where there's a will, there's a way. And that was the reason why they were able to accomplish this. I think that we could build a Stonehenge today in the same amount of time, which may have been, you know, 50, 60 years, maybe two or three generations, but we could accomplish it with simple manpower and very little technology, basically Neolithic technologies, if we had the willpower, the desire to get it accomplished, that if we felt that within us, this is something that had to be done, you will find a way to do it. And I think that's the simple answer to why and how was this constructed. But engineering wise, exactly how were these stones transported? That's still up in the air, and we're going to need more evidence in order to support any particular theory on its construction, other than just opinion based on the little evidence that we have.
A lot of the reading and listening that I've done around this suggests that in terms of how, you know, the mechanics of it, you know, cutting, transportation, putting the things together, that it's almost like there's something we haven't seen yet. You know, maybe we are missing something, either that or there's just something we haven't seen yet that's going to be the, if we ever stumble upon it, that's going to be the aha moment. You know, yeah. So that's how they could have done it. Not necessarily that's how they did it, but that's how it could have been made possible. Because I looked on with almost amusement, to be honest with you, when the teams were trying to replicate the pyramid building techniques that are claimed to have been used. And, you know, they failed miserably. And so I just think there's something there, that something else we don't know, something that's lost to us that was employed there.
Yeah, there are various technologies, very simple technologies have been proven with an ability to move the stones with not more than one or two people involved, very simple technologies. The question is, are those the technologies that were used? The problem we have is there's virtually no evidence of any technologies being used. However, in the last few years, archaeologists have found indications of trackways coming from the north, coming from where the quarry appears to have been for the Sarsen stones. And so there may have been trackways that were constructed, engineered in some fashion that would help the people to drag the stones or in some way move them along this trackway at some time during the year. But specifically what that technology was, if it was wooden, the wood's gone. It, you know, over 5,000 years, that decays away and you lose that evidence. So for lack of evidence, it's very difficult to answer it. But I don't see any reason why we should be believing that there was anything metaphysical causing it, because we lack the physical information and the data to support, you know, a real engineering means to move these stones doesn't mean we need to already fall back on the metaphysical for explaining it. I think we're just missing some information. We don't have it, and we may never have it. And those types of questions may never be answered. But I'm ever hopeful that there's something out there that's been missed.
Now, it's something you've touched on already, which is extremely important to all this. And that's the idea that many peoples around the world at this particular time, prior to that, of course, and for the longest time, in fact, probably for most of human history, it's only relatively recently that we've lost this or abandoned it, is this innate understanding of the links between life and death and the greater cosmos and what's observed in the sky and what happens here. All those sorts of subtle relationships were really, really important.
Virtually every culture that I've studied, that I'm aware of around the world and throughout time, has had some type of a, you know, what I suggest is a knowledge. As far as they were concerned, it was knowledge, but we today may be looking at it just as some type of conceptualization that wasn't knowledge but beliefs and opinions, that the spirit, that the essence of life is derived from the universe. And in fact, you know, there, that kind of, those kinds of ideas, that's right. If you look at the big picture in terms of we're still in the universe and we came from somewhere, so it must be derived in the universe somehow. But people were identifying a particular area of the cosmos, a part of the night sky that they pointed at as being the source of life, the source of spirit. And that area, time and time again, is in the vicinity of Orion and the crossing of the Milky Way and the ecliptic being the path of the sun across the sky. That general area is time and time again the area that is called out from the records that we have, the evidence that we have, that is the source of the spirit that comes to Earth, that joins with the body, becomes a human being or other physical aspect, manifestation of life on Earth, and upon death of the body, the spirit returns to that area. Of course, as I've mentioned before, that's the ancient Egyptian understanding of the spirit. That's the understanding of Native Americans, whether it be North America, Central America, South America, virtually any culture that's living a Neolithic lifestyle, including in general indigenous peoples from around the world, they are looking at the sky and a particular area of the sky, and most commonly it's that area up or around Orion. So why they are picking out that area, that's a little hard to understand. But plainly, that is the area that people are looking at in the vicinity of Sirius and the Pleiades and right around in Orion. So that's really curious, and I can't explain it at this point specifically. I've got my own ideas, but I really can't explain why they were all, everyone throughout time around the world is pointing to that area, especially if there's never any transportation or communication networks that would allow these cultures to be interacting in some fashion, yet they're all pointing to the same area. And that's very curious, but it's a fact.
Yes, I'd wondered about that as to maybe whether there had been contact and more global travel a long time previous, but then humanity had become sort of atomized as a result of, well, who knows what, but, perhaps the deluge or an ice age or something like that, and that there was a common source of knowledge, that's a possibility, I suppose.
Yeah, it's, it could be something that's built into our DNA, that it's built into the human consciousness, and it's, we start looking at cosmic consciousness, Christ consciousness, some way that we can actually interact with each other without physically being with each other, those types of things to help explain these commonalities. But it's certainly more than coincidence, and it's very possible that there were transportation and communication networks that would allow people to contact each other way back when. There's virtually no evidence, real good evidence for it, but it's a good idea. And one of my favorite sayings is that anything's possible, but few things are probable.
Well, yeah, certainly no hard evidence for any of this. How could there be? But there does seem to be persistent myths and legends of a time when things were better, more unified, when man lived in harmony with the rest of it, you know, life and existence. I mean, this, I suppose, is where the Atlantis legend comes from. But they often think that, you know, people tend to dismiss myths. But I think my feeling about it is, anyway, that we can't necessarily derive hard truths from them per se. We just don't know. But that they probably don't arise for no reason. Even if the myth itself is far removed from the reality that spawned it, I get the feeling that people, places, events actually occur, exist, and that's where the myths come from, however much, you know, they sort of get distorted down the ages like Chinese whispers.
I have no doubt that there are seeds of fact and occurrences on Earth that are described in mythologies, world mythologies, important cultural mythologies, but that they are kind of buried. They're not made very overt in these mythologies. Usually mythologies are presented in a story form and presented in a way such that from generation to generation, the same story can be related, and that in the next generation that's going to relate it to the following generation can give the same story, because that the information that is buried in there is extremely important. And I'll give you one example. The Lakota people that had constructed this medicine wheel that I found, they have a mythology that describes the four sons of the wind leaving their father's lodge, and they move out and they locate the four primary directions, the cardinal directions around where the people are going to live. And it turns out that the medicine wheel that I found in Wyoming at the top of these mountains is the specific place that is actually described in the mythology as representing the west direction for the Lakota. And it also turns out that there's a medicine wheel in East Central South Dakota, about 550 miles away, that is described in the mythology and describes this very location. The bottom line is the Lakota actually constructed a medicine wheel that is 550 miles in diameter, the largest sacred structure, a circle with a center to it, that's been constructed anywhere on Earth at any time that I'm aware of. So, you know, 550 miles in diameter, and the line from the, for example, from the west to the east through the center of that circle, which is at Bear Butte, South Dakota, is a virtual straight line. It is so straight that a surveyor today could not lay it in any straighter, barring use of GPS. It was an amazing feat of engineering. It's a huge structure. And it's described in the mythology. So there are facts, there's some history that's in these mythologies, but it's hard to, you know, cut away and get through the storyline to find those nuggets of fact that are very important. But so when we start looking at Stonehenge and Merlin, and Merlin levitating the stones and getting them over the Stonehenge, there's a story in there that has some nuggets of fact. But that doesn't mean that the stones were levitated. That may be, you know, a description that's written down somewhere, but it is a overt storyline that is giving you indications of specifically what was done, but exactly how it's buried in there. There's a reason for that too, and we haven't quite figured out what that reason is. People aren't looking at what that reason is, that hidden meaning. But I'm sure that it's there, but it's just a matter of gathering enough data on the ground to compare that with the mythology so that we can finally understand what that mythology is really trying to tell us.
The idea that you mentioned earlier about there being some sort of an innate knowing in our consciousness and a DNA somehow that's just inherent within us makes some sense when you think about this persistent idea of life coming from somewhere beyond the Earth, because that's just been there forever. And it sort of prompts the question, you know, if life on Earth really came into being and followed the path of evolution, as, you know, mainstream science would tell us, yes, certainly early humans could look up at the sky. And I mean, any of us can go outside now and do that. And, you know, the more you look at it, the more mesmerized you become by it, the awesomeness of it, the beauty. But where would this idea, this persistent idea that's everywhere, come from, that something up there is connected to what's down here? I mean, it could just have arisen, who knows, just somebody just virtually making something up because it sounded like a nice idea, building a, you know, a religion of control around the idea. Because, you know, by definition, everything that's up there, you know, particularly early humans, they couldn't get to it. They couldn't observe it in the way that we can now. So it'd be very easy to attribute all sorts of things to stuff up there. But I prefer to think that there is something to this along the lines you've suggested. It's just, again, that we don't know what it is, and maybe we can't know.
I think eventually we put our minds to it, we may begin to put together some of the puzzle and have some understanding of it. And I've got my own thoughts and opinions on this, but let me throw out this little nugget. The galactic anti-center, in other words, we have the Milky Way, which is a galaxy which is spinning, and it has these spiral arms coming out from the center. The center of the galaxy is this black hole, purported black hole at the center of the galaxy where everything is spinning out of. The galactic anti-center, from the perspective of Earth, we can point to the center of the galaxy at nighttime as being the brightest spot of the Milky Way along its line. The opposite direction, the very opposite direction, is the galactic anti-center. Now, many cultures have considered that the direction to the center of the galaxy is the source of the end of life. And the exact opposite direction, which is towards the galactic anti-center, is the source of life. And these mythologies keep bringing this up time and again around the world. So there's something real to that, I believe, that there's that these mythologies are telling you that the center of the galaxy is dangerous. There's something in that direction that is not good for the Earth and life on Earth. But in the exact opposite direction is where life can come from. That is, you know, that's a good thing. That's where we came from. That's where we return. And that's about all I can really say on that subject matter, that there seems to be a pervasive understanding around the world and throughout time where bad things come from and where good things come from in terms of life. And that has to do with the center of the galaxy and the anti-center. And it's this anti-center, which happens to be very near this crossing of the ecliptic and the Milky Way, that crossing being where Orion's right arm, his hand is reaching into the Milky Way and virtually touches on that very crossing point, which is extremely close, within a couple of degrees of the galactic anti-center. And that may be helping to tie together where this source of life is coming from, in terms of we have Orion, typically representing the human being, not just a man, but a woman, androgynous. Shiva in the Hindu religion is represented by Orion. Okay, so Orion comes up time and time again for, you know, supreme gods, important gods for many cultures. Well, there is Orion near the galactic anti-center, reaching up and taking the soul, the spirit of a human being who has died on Earth, and receiving them from the spirit pathway or the spirit road, which is the Milky Way, rising up to that intersection point of the Milky Way and the ecliptic, and Orion reaching out there and taking that spirit, upon which he then has brought home back to the stars. And when there's a need for a spirit on Earth, releasing that spirit at that point, and the spirit traveling down the Milky Way to the Earth to join with the body to become a human being or a bird or a tree or what have you. So I think those are the kinds of ideas that people were seeing time and time again. Again, it's a little difficult to understand why they're all seeing that, but that's the general scenario that seems to be coming up time and time again for basic human understanding of the source of life.
Well, I suppose the concept of good and bad coming from the outer space, you know, from the sky, whatever, has some sort of practical bearing. You think of solar activity, cosmic rays, comets, meteors. There's certainly some evidence, lots of myths as well, surrounding the idea that these sorts of things have impacted the Earth negatively in the past. And then, I suppose, on the plus side, there's the idea of the panspermia idea, that maybe life on this planet got started as a result of life coming from elsewhere.
There's evidence of amino acids, which are basic building blocks for any life, being present in the universe, in space, in the gases of space, and perhaps attached to some of the rocky pieces or in comets in space. So the basic building blocks may very well be out there. They appear to be out there to some degree. And that may be the source of the amino acids that then cooked in the soup, the primeval soup on Earth millions of years ago, and ultimately resulted in life occurring on Earth and the start of evolution. That's very possible. There's a great likelihood that the precession of the equinoxes, which is a 26,000 year cycle of the wobble of the Earth. It kind of has this wobble where the North Pole basically circumscribes this circle up in the towards the North Pole, the North Star, and also it happens through the South Pole. There's a 26,000 year cycle in which that circle is created with the Earth's wobble. Well, 13,000 years ago, there was the emission of gamma rays from the center of the Milky Way, from that black hole. And in another 13,000 years, that gamma wave blast is going to reach the Earth. It takes about 26,000 light years for something moving at the speed of light to go from the galactic center to us. And so it's interesting that there's this great wave of gamma energy that's coming from the center of the Milky Way that takes 26,000 years to reach us. And we also have this precession of the equinoxes, which is 26,000 years. So from a physics standpoint, one could be connected to the other. And it may be the reason why the Earth has this wobble of 26,000 years. And if that is a great catastrophe, if it happens every 26,000 years, it may explain why people for a very long time have been looking at the center of the galaxy and saying, this is danger, this is bad. In the opposite direction, we have the source of life. And towards where Orion is. So that, that's a possibility, but there's a lot of information that needs to be gathered in order to say that with some confidence that is, that's buried in these mythologies and explaining the source of life and the cause of these cycles that are happening on Earth every 26,000 years.
I would just at this point, because this is getting into some fascinating territory, I would refer listeners to, if they haven't already heard it, a few weeks ago I did an interview with a chap called Walter Cruttenden, and we discussed this exact cycle. But it reminds us at this point about other understandings or viewpoints that ancient peoples had, and their understanding that life was everywhere and it was in all things, which are in turn interconnected, and that their view of time and events was cyclical, not linear.
The interesting thing about cyclicity of life as it was recognized, as you say, by all ancient cultures, indigenous cultures were recognizing the cyclicity in all living things, and that includes the universe. The indigenous people of North America knew that the Earth was a sphere. They knew that the sun was a sphere, the moon was a sphere, and they believed that the stars and planets were spheres. And anyone that really pays attention is going to realize that the moon is a sphere, not because someone told them that, but if they pay attention and look at that moon and what it's doing day in and day and night, they're going to realize it's a sphere. And so it's not like people have always understood that things were flat or circles until modern science came around. That's not true at all. Ancient people could realize these things. So there's a circle that is in all things throughout the universe, and they believed that time was cyclical, and it is. One day takes one cycle, one revolution of the Earth, and one year takes one revolution of the Earth around the sun, and so forth. So there's a cyclicity of time that they were recognizing, rather than linear from us, where we go from January to December and then January again in this long timeline. It's not a line, but circles, or you might think of it as as a spring that's got a certain direction to it, but there's circles that are going on, you know, in time through that spring from one end to the other. So I think perhaps more correctly, it may be a matter of a series of circles that are connected like a spring, and that's the direction of time. But certainly people, since the beginning of human understanding or recognition of who they were on this planet and in this universe, were recognizing the cyclicity. And I think that's one of the important reasons as to why they were recognizing the importance of this cyclicity in life and the cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth.
Returning to the topic of Stonehenge itself, and in fact the general landscape around there and all the other features that we mentioned earlier, perhaps we should talk about your central idea really regarding the relationship between what's on the ground there and the sky. Because you map out, for example, the relationship between the landscape there and the winter hexagon of stars. So perhaps just talk about the relationships there.
Sure. If people aren't familiar with the winter hexagon, it's not a proper constellation, but is more what is referred to as an asterism, in which we have six stars that generally form a very large hexagon in the sky. And you can think of the bottom point of that hexagon as the star Sirius, and the very top corner of that hexagon is Capella, which is in the constellation of Auriga. And both of those stars are connected by a certain length of the Milky Way. So that's what's connecting the two from the bottom to the top end of the hexagon. And then there are four other stars that include Rigel, which is Orion's left foot, Aldebaran, which is the brightest star in Taurus, Procyon, which is the brightest star in Canis Minor, or the little dog, and then Pollux, which is a star, the brightest star in Gemini. And those six stars form this hexagon. And in the middle of winter, late December, early January, at about 8 p.m., if you look up in the clear sky to the east, people will see this winter hexagon, and I show some examples in the book so people can understand. And as a reference, they could look up at the sky and see it. So it stands out very prominently in the winter sky. It's a good time to see it in December, January at about 8 p.m. That is, again, that area includes Orion, and we have that part of the Milky Way from Sirius up to Capella, and we also have that crossing point of the ecliptic coming through there and the galactic anticenter. So they're all coming together with inside that hexagon. Now, what I've found through my analysis and my work out at Stonehenge is that the people 1,000 years before the stones were placed at Stonehenge, stones being placed at about 2500 BC, back in about 3500 BC is when archaeologists date the Greater Cursus and the Lesser Cursus, the Greater Cursus being about 1.7 miles long, and it has a width of 100 to 150 yards, and most people don't see it, they don't go to take a look at it, you know, it's just this flat ground, well, it's following along the contour of the ground surface, and there's a low ditch and mound that circumscribes it, but otherwise it doesn't seem to have any particular interest or importance to the landscape, except for it being the largest feature out there. But what I found is that specifically the Greater Cursus represents that part of the Milky Way from Sirius up to not Capella, but that intersection point with the ecliptic. And there was a long barrel at the east end of the Greater Cursus, and that was a long barrel Amesbury 42. And it's not there anymore. It's been excavated, removed, and so forth. But there's still some evidence of it that the archaeologists go back to within the subsurface. So the Greater Cursus is representing that part of the Milky Way. And then the continuing of the Milky Way from the ecliptic up to Capella is not a part of the Cursus, but it would be the area continuing along that same alignment from Amesbury 42 down to Woodhenge. Woodhenge represents Capella. And Sirius is represented by the west end of the Greater Cursus. Now, I realize this is all new. It's surprising to people. No one's been looking at these stars and recognizing this thing. But I sincerely believe that this is actually what was being constructed in 3500 BC. Essentially, it's a map of the winter hexagon area and placed onto the ground surface of Salisbury Plain. And as evidence, supporting evidence of that, if you look at the scale, the distance from Sirius to the east end of the Greater Cursus as being the distance from Sirius to the ecliptic, it turns out that very specifically the center star of Orion's belt plots exactly where Stonehenge is located. And the if you recall thinking of Orion has his sword or knife dangling down off of his waist, and there's a series of stars that drop down from the three stars of his waist. And the brightest star that you see in that area is not a star, but it's the Orion Nebula. And where if you were to plot the winter hexagon down onto Salisbury Plain, as I'm describing, it turns out that there's a long barrow exactly where it should be if it was going to represent Orion, the Orion Nebula. And if you continue plotting, you'll find that there is a long barrow exactly where Rigel should be, which is, as I was saying, another star of the winter hexagon. And Coneybarrow-Henge, which is on Coneybury Ridge, is plotted exactly where Aldebaran should be, except that there's some complications that I get to in the book, but there's every reason to believe that the Coneybury-Henge is representing Aldebaran. And the same thing goes for Pollux and Procyon on the north side of the Greater Cursus. So this, what was going on was the emplacement of the winter hexagon down onto the ground surface of Salisbury Plain. And within that area then is where all of the barrows start to be placed during the Neolithic. And then moving into the Bronze Age, we have the round barrows. And for some interesting reason, almost all the round barrows are kept outside of that area. So I think there was an understanding of what was going on previously, and people were appreciating that in the Bronze Age. So there's some connection there of the mythology and the understanding of the source of life that was going on for thousands of years, but it essentially is all founded on the translocation of the winter hexagon down onto the ground surface, something that the archaeologists and everyone else has not recognized before. But when you start looking at the Neolithic people being interested in spatial relationships, not mathematical, that the universe operates spatially, not mathematically. The Earth doesn't care about numbers, but it does care about its distance from the sun and to the moon, and it reacts based on those distances and those energies to create the orbit that it has, the movement that it has through space. So all energies are impacted by each other from distances, from space. The numbers, as they are calculated out by physicists, those numbers are for us humans to use so we can understand those spatial relationships. But these people in the Neolithic were creating those spatial relationships between stars and other phenomena like the Milky Way and the ecliptic and placing that onto the ground surface. Now, why would they ever be doing that? The same thing was being done in Egypt, and that's been shown to be the case, that Orion was very important and pyramids were being placed to represent certain stars of Orion. And the Lakota people in North America had a complete mythology and cosmology, a cosmography. So again, we're looking at spatial relationships up in the cosmos that they had in place down on the ground surface across the northern Great Plains. Many cultures laid upon the ground surface this very same area, which appears to be also have been translocated onto Salisbury Plain. So it turns out this isn't a really unusual phenomenon. Neolithic cultures have done that thing, that very type of thing, over many thousands of years around the world. It just happens to now, in my book, I'm presenting very strong evidence that this was actually being done here in Britain 5,500 years ago.
I've always been fascinated by the various structures, ancient structures and sites that are not really visible from the ground in the sense that you can't get the full picture of what they are. And whether it's you know, chalk horses in England, or whether it's, you know, Eric von Daniken's UFO landing strips in South America, these things that you can't see fully from the ground, is there a sense of human beings saying to someone else or something else, look what we've done?
If we look at the pyramids of Egypt, they're huge structures. The question is, why are they so large? We can see them from a number of kilometers or miles away, but they're tremendously huge structures, as is the Greater Cursus, 1.7 miles long, 100 to 150 miles wide, and it's surrounded by this bank and ditch, which originally, when the Cursus would have been constructed and outlined by the bank and ditch, that bank and ditch would have come out as white chalk, so very easily seen from above. So what people on Salisbury Plain 5,500 years ago were doing, what they were constructing circles on the ground surface, again, representing the sphere, representing sacred relationships, representing particular stars or locations in the sky that were related to the source of life, the source of spirit. And those structures, the cursus, the hinges, and so forth, could be seen from the sky. So we have the gods, if you will, Orion in some fashion, the stars as the sources of life looking down on Earth and seeing themselves on Earth, or seeing those star locations, or seeing a reflection of themselves down here. So as we see that up in the sky, so below, the stars themselves, the source of life themselves, are seeing this very same representation on Earth. And that's why I call the book Stonehenge, As Above, So Below, because this is what they were doing. The people were constructing this translocation of the source of life onto the ground surface.
We should also say something about the station stones, because that's another feature of Stonehenge that's generally overlooked.
Yeah, the station stones are interesting because virtually everything else, all the other structures associated with Stonehenge, are in circles. The trilithons, the five trilithons, form a kind of a part of an egg shape or a horseshoe shape. But all other structures that were there before, in terms of the megaliths and the ditch and bank itself, are all forming circles. And then we have the four station stones, which form a rectangle, or not quite a rectangle. I would call it more of a quadrilateral, because it forms four sides of a structure that isn't quite square. It's not all four sides don't have the same length as any of the others. So it's a quadrilateral, but it's not a quadrilateral, but it's not quite a rectangle. And I think that that's important to recognize, that there wasn't a need to create a very specific rectangular structure there, but it could be approximate. And that's because we're dealing with the sacred. And when you're dealing with sacred structures and sacred geometries that come through in ancient and indigenous cultures, exactness isn't as important as the symbolism that's being created. So I've determined that there had to be some symbolism that's associated with these four stones, the station stones, the way that they were placed at Stonehenge. And through a lot of analysis of spatial relationships of stars and the fact that Orion was important and so forth, it turns out that specifically what was happening at Stonehenge then is somewhat of a microcosm of what was going on the landscape for miles and miles around Stonehenge, this translocation of the winter hexagon onto the ground surface. At Stonehenge, there's a translocation of Orion himself, and the four station stones are representing points, four points around Orion that would define a rectangular area or near rectangular area, two of those four points being Sirius and Aldebaran, again, the brightest star in Taurus. And those four points represent the area surrounding Orion. And what was done then was that was symbolically translocated and placed down onto Stonehenge. And by doing so, the center star of Orion's Belt plots right into the center of Stonehenge. So that's evidence, good evidence that this is what they were thinking, what they were doing. And so that's what the four station stones represent. It's not necessarily all that important regarding the rise or fall of the setting of the sun or the moon. That may have been a part of it, but even these alignments are approximate. What's more important, what they were doing was they're translocating that source of life in the cosmos and sending it down onto Mother Earth. What Stonehenge represents is the womb of Mother Earth. And we have the translocation of Orion at a certain time of the year, which happens to be in early August, which is important from understanding Celtic festivals, because I believe the Celtic festivals are derived from earlier festivals and understandings from as much as 1,500, 2,000 years before. And the Celts are practicing some parts of their religion based on what they had learned, had evolved from previous cultures there. So we have some evidence of this. There's the rotation of Orion down onto Mother Earth. We have the conception of the new life for the coming year. We have the old king. We have the new king in being the sun, the new life for the coming year. And we have the Mother Earth involved here. And some of those concepts of the new king, old king, and Mother Earth and so forth are pretty well understood, but haven't been recognized to this detail regarding Stonehenge. But I was able to find those connections because I was curious about what are those four station stones there? Why aren't they in a circle? There's something particular about them and must be very important, or they wouldn't have been put in there as they were. And it turns out from an astronomical point of view, that setup, that quadrangle of those station stones fits exactly as it should in order to define the area of Orion at a particular time of year, so that the mythology and the festivals that are occurring at that time of year can happen.
Well, I think that's a very important point to take away from all of this as well, is that, you know, things are not there for no reason in sites like this. It just doesn't happen like that. And that because we can't explain something, it's not enough to say, oh, well, you know, it's maybe, I don't know, it's decorative or it was just a practical thing, but we don't know what it is yet. It's all of great significance.
If you understand the symbolism, if you understand the universal symbolism of the circle, and that anything that's constructed from a sacred standpoint and placed on the earth is vital, it needed to be there, it's indicating something specifically, and that it's sacred. When you understand that symbolism, and it's pervasive around the world, then you will understand the meaning of these structures, not only Stonehenge, but the great pyramids and the great temples in India and on and on. You need to understand that symbolism. You don't have to believe in it. You don't have to believe that the source of life is coming from the center of the winter hexagon. I'm not saying I believe it. Archaeologists don't have to believe it. None of us need to believe it. But we do need to understand that the people that constructed these structures believed this. And then we can understand why they were constructing them, why it was important for them to drag these stones as far as they did, because they are celebrating, they are demonstrating their knowledge of the source of life. And they constructed these structures out of stone because they wanted them to last eternally. If they wanted these structures to just last for their lifetimes, they would have used wood posts. They didn't. They constructed them out of stone, and those stones are still there. They did a magnificent job of constructing something that's going to last for many thousands of years beyond our lifetimes. So it's an amazing structure from many standpoints. But when you recognize that symbolism and what it means, it's a perfect example of fact being more interesting than fiction.
Well, I just want to throw a couple of questions to you that are beyond the scope of your book. But as I've got you on here, Stonehenge expert, I'd be remiss of me not to put them to you. Have you ever explored or learned anything about potential sonic properties of Stonehenge itself? It's something I've read a little bit about, and people have various theories about it, but they say that it has significant sonic properties.
Yeah, I think the materials of the stones that were used at Stonehenge, the sarsen sandstone, which I think of more as a quartzite, much harder than what you think of as a sandstone being. It's a very hard material, very durable. And I suspect there isn't a lot of evidence to really directly support, but I believe that there may be a sonic reasons why those stones were used. That being that they're very hard materials and therefore they will reflect sounds very readily and very accurately. They'll send back virtually the same frequency in a sound as they receive from a source. And so I've been very curious. I've been interested in conducting some studies of sound in Stonehenge, in particular because I'm playing with this idea that the source of the megalithic yard, which we have no evidence to point to where this 2.71 feet is derived from for the megalithic yard, which has been proposed as the standard length that was used to lay out these structures, that it may be related to the speed of sound at a particular frequency, and that one possibly could measure it very accurately if one beats a drum or hits a stick from a known distance away from these stones and records how quickly that sound hits the stone and returns to you. You could actually come out from at a certain frequency with 2.71 as a length, as representing seconds or a certain period of time. And it turns out that in the ancient scale of music, that one of the important notes in this ancient scale at that particular frequency, it turns out that that an important wavelength for that frequency comes out to be 2.71 feet. So I'm kind of curious if that's a connection, but I don't have anything to really support that, but the numbers seem to work out for it. But again, you've got to go back to space. You've got to look at the distances between the sound and the stone and see if it actually works. So I'm interested in studying that. I think that may be one of the reasons why Stonehenge was laid out, possibly with the megalithic yard.
Oh, well, that's interesting in itself. The other point is, as I say, it's a point really more than a question, it's just a thought, is that I've noticed, and as of others, in more recent times, but military interest in certain ancient sites, and that sometimes even translates into military bases being in the vicinity. Have you got any thoughts on that whatsoever?
I'm not sure what the connection is. One, is there even a connection other than it just happenstance? And yeah, I guess that could be it could be just coincidental, or it could be something like there's a recognition of the importance of these structures. Nothing conspiracy wise or really unusual, but there's this recognition by important people on this planet over time that these structures are very important. They're vital. They contain important information. It's recognized to some degree, and they're being protected. And it's just that we don't understand what that all means or what the inference is, and those people might not know, but there's still this recognition that we need to take care of these structures for some reason. And I don't have any reason to believe that there's, again, this big conspiracy or something is buried under Stonehenge. There's no evidence for that all. It's possible, again, but the question is it probable? And so based on the information that I've seen from the archaeologists and so forth, there's no reason to believe there's something weird going on there, that there's some conspiracy that we're not being given the information on. But it could be as simple as people recognizing the importance, or it could be just coincidence that these military facilities are built nearby. I don't know, but I haven't really pursued that angle either.
No, well, thank you for indulging in speculation. That's that was fun. Well, as we begin to bring things to a close for today, Paul, if you're correct, and certainly the evidence is compelling, what changes? What do you think the implications are for what we think we know about Stonehenge and research and just the whole field?
Well, I think that the importance here of what I'm bringing to the table in my book is that none of the information, none of the data, none of the conclusions that are being drawn is in conflict with any of the archaeological information that's been gathered to date. In fact, it supports the archaeology, and the archaeology, all of it, supports my findings. There's no conflict here at all. What I'm bringing to the table is new evidence, new interpretation of existing data that very well supports the idea that of this translocation of parts of the cosmos onto the ground surface at Salisbury Plain, which is no different than what many other cultures, Neolithic cultures throughout time, have been doing. So none of this should be that unusual or surprising. It's just surprising that we found it at Stonehenge because no one's been looking for it. So it gives all the more reason for accepting this theory that I have. To me, it's more than a theory. I think this is exactly what was going on, because the analysis, the time frame, all of the archaeology fits exactly the way it should for what I found. So I've come from it from a different angle, and yet both the archaeology and the astronomy and the engineering that was required, they all come together at one point and demonstrate that these were the things that were going on at Stonehenge at the time. That's very important to realize. I'm not looking at creating something that's sensational, but at the same time, it will move, I believe, our understanding of Stonehenge and the landscape ahead by decades, because now, if I'm correct in what I'm proposing here, then we can move farther ahead with the archaeology and the additional information that we gain in the future, and be able to connect it specifically to the geometry of Stonehenge and the other monuments that are out there specifically. In other words, it's been believed for some time now by the archaeologists that the Greater Cursus must have been a procession way for people to bring the dead along the Cursus, and they turn at some point and they head over to Stonehenge. But there's no evidence for processions happening on the Greater Cursus. It's just, well, what else can it be? It must be this. Well, turns out it's not a procession way for people. It's a procession way for the spirit to return back to the stars and to come from the stars down to Earth. And it being a sacred structure, people are not supposed to be within it. It isn't a procession way for people. It is the spirit path for the spirit to come and go to and from Earth and the stars. So with these new interpretations, now we've got a better understanding of what the new data is going to bring to us. And it's going to be a question of, does that data now support what we're believing now is what was going on there, or is it conflicting with it? And as yet, I haven't seen anything that would conflict with what I'm describing in my book.
Well, in conclusion, Paul, the book itself is widely available, all the usual outlets, as they say. Perhaps you'd like to just share with listeners details of your website and anything else you'd like to put out there.
Sure. Yeah, the book is widely available on the internet. It is going into bookstores. It's only been out for about 3 weeks now. It came out March 28th, so it's relatively new, but it's been in the number one spot around the world on Amazon for ancient civilizations, for those types of books that have come out in the last few months. So it rapidly shot up to number one on Amazon. I was a little surprised at that, but it's available on the internet. It's going into bookshops. It's going into book chains. That takes a little longer for it to happen. My website is Paul D. Burley. D as in Donald, pauldburley.com. And that website is basically dedicated to the sacred sphere, which again provides the foundation for what I'm talking about on the Stonehenge book. But quite soon I'll have another website up that's dedicated to Stonehenge, as above, so below. So look for that, and I will be announcing that website soon on the pauldburley.com website. Otherwise, people can also obtain the book through the publisher's website, which is New Generation Publishing. And they're located in London, but through their website, the book is also available. So there are many resources that people can go to. Reviews of the book on Amazon and so forth, and so there's information out there, and I hope people will take advantage of that and take a look at the book, because again, it's a whole new paradigm on Stonehenge and the environment, and I really think it's going to make a big difference to our understanding of what what people were doing out there many thousands of years ago, and just how sacred that entire area is, not just for those people that built the landscape, but for ourselves as well, because what they were doing back then, it's sacred. It's just as sacred as it is now as it was then, and we should be protecting that environment, enjoying it, but protecting it and understanding how important that site is to all of humanity.
Excellent. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you very much. I've really appreciated it, Greg.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy the show, please check out the website. That's LegalizeFreedom.com, Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including world affairs, politics and economics, science and technology, religion and spirituality, conspiracy, and alternative history. You can also browse and buy a range of books and DVDs from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.